This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. By the time Mary Dell Chilton was a freshman in high school, many people already knew she was brilliant. Her scores were so high on aptitude tests that some school administrators were convinced that she had cheated. She hadn't. She has proved this many times over throughout her career. Mary Dell's work pioneered the field of agricultural biotechnology. As a young researcher, she led the team that produced the first genetically modified plant. She moved to North Carolina in the early 1980s, where she continued to conduct research that shaped the production of corn, cotton, and other crops. She founded Syngenta's biotechnology research labs and has authored more than 100 scientific publications. And she was awarded the World Food Prize in 2013 and also recently was inducted into the National Inventors Hall of Fame. And she shows no signs of wanting to retire. She still spends most of her time in the laboratory, where she continues to improve technology for gene transfer. Mary Dell Chilton is currently Syngenta Distinguished Science Fellow and a principal scientist and joins us now in the studio. Welcome to State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much, Frank. It's a pleasure.
Quite a distinguished career that gets started in Indianapolis. Tell us about your early days in Indianapolis, Indiana.
I was a baby, so I don't remember much about Indianapolis.
Then you moved on to Illinois?
Place I remember is Southern Pines, North Carolina.
Right. And tell us how you came to stay there. You were living down here when some of your family was still in Indiana.
I came to North Carolina with my grandmother to visit the grandparents for a while. And it turned into a very long visit. I stayed there for about 10 years.
Why did you stay here so long with your grandparents?
I don't rightly know, but I did.
So tell us about that, growing up with your grandparents in Southern Pines.
I loved Southern Pines. I loved the sunshine and the beautiful longleaf pine trees. I loved the horseback riding, and I even kind of liked the piano lessons that I had to take.
And your granddad, known as Daddy Hayes, I guess, right?
That's right.
Owned a bookstore?
Yes, he did.
Did you hang out there a lot?
I did. My grandfather, Daddy Hayes, allowed me to read as many of his comic books as I wanted, as long as I kept them clean and put them back in good order.
Ooh, that would be great. Were you reading anything else but comic books in those first 10 years here?
I read all the horse stories and all the dog stories that I could get my hands on.
And your grandmother was a retailer, had a hat shop, right? She was making hats?
She had Mrs. Hayes' dress shop, but she did sell the first ready-made hats. Ladies made their own hats back in those days. Wow. But she went to New York and got onto the idea you could make money selling hats. So she did.
Were you ever interested in that part of the business? Did you hang around her?
I would have told you no, I wasn't interested in selling. But I obviously must have been interested in clothing, because I'm the world's greatest shopper now. Love to go shopping.
That's what we hear about you. When you're not in the lab, you're at the mall.
That's me.
Well, we're going to get to more of that, but I want to. We're still in Southern Pines now. In those first years, your parents are in Indianapolis. You're with your grandparents in Southern Pines for about the first 10 years of your life. Then you did go back. Now, your dad worked in insurance.
That's right, yes.
And your mom, tell us about her, because she worked for a hearing aid company.
She did for a time. My grandmother was deaf and had Sonatone hearing aids. They were great big things, bigger than transistor radios, and a similar size package of batteries that she wore on her leg. But anyway, my mother knew about Sonatone from that and applied to the Sonatone company to be a hearing aid salesperson. Turned out she was good at that. So we were living in Elgin, Illinois at that time, and she ran the Sonatone office. I can remember her picking up the telephone and answering, "Good morning, Sonatone."
Did you have any interest in that? I mean, that's the sort of a kind of a technical field, and as you say, she was selling the product, but were you ever interested in sort of how that worked?
I should have been, because I've become a hearing aid wearer myself now, But no, I wasn't particularly interested in that. It wasn't a technical field, really. It was a very human field. My mother had to help people, help them to get their instrument to work properly for them so that they could hear, help them to understand speech and so on. It's a very human-oriented activity.
That's
to sell hearing aids.
She did so it wasn't just – she wasn't done after the sale was made. She stayed with the customer and did essentially
Oh, yes.
In-person support, I guess.
Absolutely.
Did you ever go on the rounds with her?
No, she stayed in her office. The people came to her. And yes, I sat in her office with her sometimes. Yes.
Now what about that transition? You'd been away for, you know, several years. Now you make this transition back to your immediate family. What was that like?
It was sort of a shock, I guess you'd say. It was very different. My grandparents had a fairly prosperous-looking household, whereas my mother and father ran a little four-room house with two bedrooms, one of which was for my mother and dad, and the other of which was for my two brothers. So I didn't have a bedroom. Yeah. I slept on the couch.
And this is Elgin, Illinois, which I'm sure is different than Southern Pines, North Carolina.
Cold, snowy weather, yes.
Which leads to one of your first scientific discovery, or at least the one that is very memorable to you, seeing those corduroy suits hanging out on the line.
That's right, yeah. If you hung out your corduroy suits that you had just washed, they froze stiff in the cold wind, but they dried nevertheless. So that was my first learning that ice can evaporate, can sublime.
Without melting first.
Without
you didn't
ever
see
melting,
little
right?
drops. See, and if you'd have been down here, that never would have happened. I don't think the same effect. You don't get the same effect with seersucker that you do with corduroy.
Probably not.
I'm guessing. So that was a lucky find. Was that how your mind – did you find that your mind was always working that way, looking at things? Because when I heard that story about you, I was nearly embarrassed that hadn't occurred to me, that watching a thing go from frozen to dry without ever seeing the water means that it didn't have to melt to evaporate. And I thought, I didn't notice that. Was your mind always working like that? Were you always finding those little tricks?
Not that I recall. Mm. I don't know.
That was the first one. So, but what did that do for you? I mean, it's a great story. Were you then, did you become interested in science then, or had you always been interested?
Not a bit. I was interested in painting and horses and dogs. No, I didn't know anything about science.
So when did that happen? When did you get interested?
When I was a freshman in high school, I had to take a makeup science course because we had moved to Hinsdale, Illinois, and there wasn't, in my background, there was no science course, whereas the kids in their school system had a year of science. So I had to take science as a freshman. Nobody else did.
Today we are meeting the queen of agrobacterium on the state of things. Mary Dell Chilton. So you take this remedial course. That should be the thing that turns you off to science, right? Having to take it again, being told essentially you're not good enough, right? Why did that pique your interest in science?
I was a good student. You know, I made straight A's. I liked school, and I was interested. I was fascinated, actually.
And you had a teacher who said that you were good at it.
He did.
So what did that mean? Did they open doors for you, or did you just were there avenues and special classes then available? Could you spend time after school with that teacher? What happened next?
That teacher left us after a couple of years. He said that he had to leave us because he didn't make enough money teaching to raise his family. But he said he was sorry to go. He was a wonderful teacher. It was a shame.
You then decided, though, that to take him seriously. What did that mean for you? And was it difficult when you were taking science? I mean, we still hear this today, that there are barriers for women taking science, that there are still obstacles and expectations that women won't do well in science. Did you feel that as a young woman growing up?
What barriers?
Okay.
No. What woman? I was a person. I wasn't a woman.
Mm-hmm. Taking science. So what kinds of science then were you interested in? You start out in physics. Now, obviously, chemistry is...
Well, you're getting into college now. In high school, you took biology as a sophomore and chemistry as a junior and physics as a senior. And that was it. So I started out as a physics major in college, but I really didn't like it very well. It was kind of boring, I guess. It was a rehash of what I'd learned in high school.
Yeah, and I guess a lot of answers. Although, still back in high school, didn't you do a project where that had to do with telescopes?
That came later, and not as part of a class. It was a science fair project gone awry, so to speak. It was my friend's science fair project, and I was just helping her with it. But pretty soon, it became my project, and she backed out of it.
Well, and it had to do with telescopes, and you were warned, apparently, that, you know, did you have, a catalog of telescopes or ideas, things you could make?
I had a book that was called Amateur Telescope Making, and there was a chapter in that book that was entitled How to Make a Cassegrain Telescope and Why Not To. That was an open dare, and I took it.
Very complicated. We won't ask you how you made that, but you did it. Now, when you say going awry, did it work, or was the warning well placed?
Yeah, it worked. It worked.
But it was considered one of the most complicated, difficult things to make. This is not. They don't recommend you do this at home.
No.
And you did. That was physics, or at least astrophysics. We'll talk about how you then became, once you got to college, interested in chemistry and a lifelong career in chemistry. Mary Dell Chilton is known for her work producing the first genetically modified plant. She currently serves as principal scientist at Syngenta, and our conversation will continue on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachel. My guest this hour, Mary Dell Chilton, nicknamed the Queen of Agrobacterium for her work producing the first genetically modified plant. She's been working in Research Triangle Park since the early 80s and continues to serve as the principal scientist at Syngenta. So we're talking about your interest, growing interest in science. You defy the instructions and you do make a telescope at home. That's pretty complicated. But ultimately, you end up in the chemistry lab. What drew you to chemistry?
Well, chemistry was the next thing above physics in the scientific world. I liked chemistry because this was a topic in which I could ask a question and they didn't know the answer yet. Mm. You know, with physics, that was not the case. So I could see the edge. I could see the research edge in chemistry, and I liked that.
What were the edges for you? What were the questions you were asking that no one could answer?
Goodness, I can't even remember anymore.
You're just looking at the puzzled looks on your instructors' faces, and that's what kept you going.
Sure.
That's fascinating because I think this is a point worth reinforcing, that good scientists and good science is about not knowing. And good scientists are people who are very comfortable in this frontier of not knowing. It's not about reciting what we already know.
Exactly so.
You are doing chemistry. Your DNA then got to be very interested. And, of course, at this time, this is when we're doing some of the first discoveries about DNA.
Molecular biology was just invented at that time. The Journal of Molecular Biology was newborn at about that time. And I was in graduate school at this point, and I had to have a minor. So I chose microbiology as my minor. And the first course I took in microbiology was called The Chemical Basis of Biological Specificity. It was all about DNA and RNA and protein and how the information was transferred from one to the other. I was enraptured. I loved it. I was so curious about how all of this worked. And it was easy to ask questions to which we didn't know the answers.
Well, now I'm really going to hold your feet to the fire. What were those questions that you had initially when you turned onto the world of DNA?
We were first working on the genetic code at that time. So what is it in the DNA that tells it how to make a protein? Which amino acid to put in next and next after that? So that was one point. The thing that grabbed me most was a process that we called bacterial transformation. I could purify DNA and mix it with a bacterium, and the DNA would be slurped up by the bacterium, and it could recombine with the chromosome of the bacterium and go into the proper place. It could correct a mistake in a mutation in the bacterium's chromosome. And that looked as though it was a molecule with brains. I wanted to know how those brains worked.
Taking DNA, healthy DNA, putting it into this bacterium, and then having it reintroduced into its own genetic strand.
Exactly.
And fix itself. This stuff was brand new at the time, right? I mean, this is the very beginning of this kind of research.
It was.
Were you imagining where this could take you, what you could do with this as you learned more? Could you see outcomes?
The outcome I could see is that I would never be able to get a job doing this. But it was so much fun and so interesting that I did it anyway.
That's fascinating. I mean, at the time, there didn't seem to be any real practical applications for this kind of
research. Oh, no. Wow. No, nothing.
Tell me, your older brother was also pursuing a scientific career, and I guess the two of you took a class together, right?
Oh, we did. It was Pete's class, my brother Pete. We had a class in photosynthesis, and I can remember this was the year that Sputnik flew over. We were in that photosynthesis class, and we all went out on the lawn and watched the Sputnik fly over our heads. I certainly didn't appreciate the ramifications of that for my future career. But Sputnik led to good funding for academic science for decades after that.
Did you personally have a sense of being in a competition, that science was going to be important sort of as a national enterprise, a national defense or security enterprise?
I was a freshman in college. How would I know that? No. No, I didn't. I had no idea.
Yeah.
Looking back, I see it. But
so you talked about the fact that you didn't think there was much of a career in this choice, pursuing this kind of research, but you did get your PhD in biochemistry.
I did.
Was anybody advising you to do this, or were they advising you not to?
I didn't get any advice one way or the other, no. I was doing what interested me.
Your father was, I guess, supportive to a certain extent, but also warned you that you better have a backup career. Is that right?
My father had lesser aspirations for me, I would say. When I was in high school, the one thing he insisted on was that I take a typing class. He said, "You can always make a living pounding a typewriter." So. He's right. I did make a living pounding a typewriter from a certain point of view.
A certain point of view. But it wasn't retyping other people's work.
No. Nope.
Not by a long shot. You moved to Seattle to follow your advisor. Tell us about the move to Seattle.
Oh, that was a big cultural shock. My advisor, Benjamin Hall, moved from the chemistry department at Illinois to a genetics department at the University of Washington. And so it was a whole new field of science. And I knew nothing. I knew very little about the science of genetics, but I learned. And again, I was fascinated. DNA makes genetics happen, so I liked it.
What was the culture there at UW? Was there a pretty big department, a lot of people who were on the cutting edge? Was it a supportive environment, or were they just getting started too?
It was there were not very many genetics departments in existence at that time, as I recall. We had very good students who've gone on to really stellar careers. I remember one of Linus Pauling's children was one of my classmates in the genetics department, and the kids were doing all kinds of different things. There were fruit flies and yeasts. All these odd organisms that I hadn't worked with before, didn't know anything about.
Again, was this all pure science, or were there some researchers looking for applications in this research?
At least the kids that I knew were doing pure science.
Yeah.
I learned of applications later on the more medical side, but
speaking of Linus Pauling's children, you began dating around this time, right, and would meet the man who would become your husband in Seattle?
Yes, Scott. He was an associate professor in the chemistry department.
You did get married. You had a family. Were you pursuing this career? Did you feel that having a family would be a drawback for you as a scientist?
Well, it wasn't an issue. I mean, I decided I was going to do that. We decided we were going to do that, I should say. I was going to do both. And I had lots of energy and lots of will. Mm. I've been a very willful, competitive person all my life. So, no, it wasn't a problem. It was something I was going to do, and I did it.
But it took all that energy and it took all that will, which suggests there were challenges. What were they?
Well, there's never enough time for a young mother and a young scientist both. I actually talked to my little boys about that. I told them if they wanted to have a mother who was happy that she was going to be a mother that worked on her science, and that was the way it was going to be. And they seem to accept that. They don't in any way now resent that that they didn't have more attention as little boys.
It's a good theory. If mom's happy, you're happy. It's a good theory if you think about it.
They bought it.
You could probably prove it. You also were out one time collecting mushrooms. That was Scott's work, your husband Scott's work, right?
Oh, yes, yeah. Scott worked on poisonous mushrooms, actually, the amanitas. He worked on the toxins that that they make. So the little boys and I and Scott would go out in the field and collect these wonderful mushrooms. They're beautiful. They're red with white spots on them. And I remember one time a helpful mushroom expert stopped us on the trail and asked Scott, do you know what those are, those things in your basket? I guess he thought we were collecting for the pot. He had a picture of us feeding these toxic mushrooms to our little blonde-headed boys.
So what did you do? Because I can imagine having a lot of fun at that moment, but you might have just fessed up and said you're doing research. Do you remember what happened?
Yeah, Scott fessed up.
What kind of research was he doing? What was he looking at those mushrooms for?
He was looking at some of the non-protein amino acids. There are amino acids other than the ones in our proteins, and they turn out sometimes to be toxic. So, yeah, the mushroom makes those.
Do we have those? Do we have non-protein amino acids?
I don't know. I don't think so. I don't think so.
We're not there picking humans, so how would you know?
Yeah.
So you get a new research idea after you see a student present a paper. Tell us about that.
Oh, yes. I was at home with my second baby, and Professor Helen Whiteley called me up and asked me to come in and help her by teaching a class on methods in molecular biology. So I was happy to do that. One of my students presented a paper on agrobacterium, and I became fascinated with this story. Apparently, people thought that agrobacterium might be moving genes from itself into plant cells, into plants. It made galls on plants. But as I looked at the publications, they were terrible. They hadn't done the proper controls, so you couldn't really believe the results. They hadn't done it right. I went to the guy's professor and said, you know, I know the right experiments to do to test this, whether DNA is transferred from the bacterium to the plant cells. I know exactly how to do that. I can write us a grant application to get myself a salary, and we can start a project.
And you did.
We did. In short,
it's interesting to think about that because I'm going to try to explain this in my own little lay way. You feel free to correct me when I'm wrong here, but the idea is we think of a plant as being infected. Some sort of outside agent introduces itself to the plant. The plant reacts, and there's a kind of pathogenic reaction, right? It grows a gall. It gets sick. It's fighting against this thing, and we think it's just a kind of battle royal, right? This outside agent and the plant are at war. But the suggestion here is that, in fact, the bacterium is bringing in some DNA and introducing it to the plant so that the plant is now an agent of the bacterium. I'm turning you into me, in a sense.
In a sense, really what's happening is that the bacterium is being a genetic engineer. He's just like me, Mary Dell. He's plowing the field of the future. He's making this plant produce a gall, and the gall is full of food for other agrobacteria. So
he's farming.
He is.
He's farming. He's plowing the ground, and he's creating.
Absolutely is, yes.
And so this, how new was this idea, the idea that this was going on with bacteria?
The idea was old, but the evidence was the first solid evidence that was going on. And once we had that evidence, also the technology came along. Several new things came along that made all of this possible. So I got on the right problem at the right time. One point was they discovered that agrobacterium had circular DNA molecules. We call them plasmids. And until we knew that the plasmids were in there, we didn't know what DNA to look for. So the plasmids are what allow it to be virulent and make these galls. And it's part of the plasmid that's transferred into the plant cell.
Does the bacteria run around his whole life with this, or is there something about its interaction with the plant that then produces those plasmids? I wonder, I'm getting at how dynamic is this process of implanting genes?
Well, plasmids, you know, things aren't created out of nothing.
Yeah.
Plasmids come from other plasmids, and Agrobacterium gets these from other bacteria.
Wow.
So does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does, yeah. Because, again, it points to the dynamism in all of this, that there's, in a sense, a kind of collaboration among the bacteria. Hey, fellas, give me some of this stuff. I'll go inside there. I'll make us a nice little homestead. I'll make
exactly.
us a farm.
Yeah.
So all of this cooperation and relationship is going on, sometimes at the expense of the plant. Certainly, if you're a bacterium, you're happy as a mite. Sorry for the mixed analogies here. You'll have to fix this a little later. Fascinating stuff. So now you actually prove it. You've done good science that can give us the proof that we've about something we've long suspected. What was the reaction? Did you get much attention?
Yeah, I got lots of attention. We got lots of invitations to give seminars. When we tried to publish the paper, the referees were, I think they were kind of dumbfounded. They couldn't see anything wrong with it. We had done all the proper controls, but they didn't like it. They just didn't believe it. So they suggested that we do two or three other experiments, and then they would consider the paper. We did the experiments. They came out as we would have expected, predicted, and eventually the paper was accepted for publication in a journal called Cell. It was one of the leading journals in this field.
You're listening to The State of Things. I'm talking with agrobiologist Mary Dell Chilton today, winner of the 2013 World Food Award, one of many awards that she has received in a long life of science. You and your team ended up working primarily in tobacco plants, right?
We did, yes. Tobacco was the white rat of the plant kingdom. The reason for it is if you give me a tobacco cell, I can grow it into a whole tobacco plant easily.
Is that not, that's not true of other crops?
Yeah, other crops can be done, but with more or less great difficulty. So there's a whole gradation of difficulty, but tobacco is the easiest.
So it's the white rat or the fruit fly of the animal kingdom, or the plant kingdom. What about other industries? Were they read this thing now? The paper is approved. Everybody's happy with the science. Were other businesses beyond tobacco, other agribusinesses interested in your research?
Not yet. Not yet. We had a ways to go. We had to figure out, you know, the agrobacterium made a gall, and the gall, the cells of a normal tobacco plant would grow back into a whole plant, but the gall cells would not do that. So we had to figure out a way to disarm agrobacterium so that it didn't make these funny gall cells. We had to have normal transformed cells so that they would regenerate into a plant.
All right, this suggests at this point that you're on a mission. You do have an application in mind.
We do. We do. Right,
what is it? What are you thinking of doing with this?
Well, clearly you could put genes of our choice into plant cells, and if they were normal plant cells, you could grow them back into a transgenic plant. We didn't have that word yet, but it was coming. It was coming soon.
Is there any sense, I mean, we understand sort of the pathogenic nature of these bacterium and their implanting genes. It hurts them. It creates these galls. Any sense that this might also account for evolution, mutations that were helpful to a plant that may have long since been disguised? We don't realize it, but perhaps a bacterium was the one that introduced this mutation? Or is that not part of the research?
That's a fascinating idea, Frank. I think I'm not aware of any evidence for that, but it's something worth looking around for, yeah.
Well, maybe after lunch you can go back to the lab and give me a report if you wouldn't
mind. Yeah, just don't get under my wheels.
You're working on something else. So tell us about this now. Now you're working in the tobacco industry. As you said, the rest of the corn and soybean world hasn't found you yet, or they're not particularly interested. What kinds of research were you doing? What were you trying to do with the tobacco?
Well, the first thing was to disarm the agrobacterium, take the tumor-inducing genes out of this plasmid. And we found out what part of the plasmid gets transferred. It's marked. on the plasma. There's a little DNA sequence on each end, and what's between those DNA sequences gets transferred to the plant. So all we had to do was throw away what was between and put in what we wanted. And I say all we had to do, it was not easy.
Yeah, I think we'll take a break here and come back and find out how you did that and what discoveries it led to. And my conversation with Mary Dell Chilton continues, a scientist, an inventor, and a pioneer in the field of agricultural biology, now the principal scientist at Syngenta, where she continues her work on gene transfer. Our conversation on the state of things continues in just a moment. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, talking this hour with scientist Mary Dell Chilton. She won the 2013 World Food Prize and was recently inducted into the National Inventors Hall of Fame. 76 years old, still working every day at a lab at Syngenta. When we were talking about doing your research out there in Seattle, you did come to North Carolina. What brought you here?
A company called Ciba Geigy decided to make a move in biotechnology. And I guess all the men had been hired, so all they could find was a woman to recruit for the leadership of their biotechnology unit.
What were they looking to do?
They were looking to serve their seed companies with whatever this new technology could bring, and they didn't know exactly. That was part of the job, was to figure out how to mesh what I knew with what the company needed.
What this later became Syngenta, Ciba Geigy,
right,
evolved, and you were leading the team.
There wasn't any team. I had to hire them.
Well, now, again, I know you recoil in horror at this idea of a woman in science, but you were a woman in science, and there was, whether you felt it or not, a kind of, we have heard, some pushback, some resistance to women. Did you feel it? Did you feel any sense that as a woman you had to work harder to pull a team together?
I did not. I worked as hard as I could anyway.
So tell us about the research. What were you actually particularly working on for Ciba Geigy at the time?
Well, as I said, part of the job was to develop a project portfolio for Ciba Geigy. And we quickly learned that we had an unhappy marriage of their needs with my abilities, because I knew how to make transgenic tobacco, and they were not in the tobacco business. They were in the corn business. Agrobacterium didn't infect corn plants. So right there, we were facing a problem.
How'd you solve it?
We solved it by recruiting Christian Harms, who knew how to grow corn plants back from individual corn cells. And then we hired a bunch of people in my line of work who could train Agrobacterium to attack a corn cell, which it did not want to do at first.
So first you got to sort of train them to be aggressive, and then you got to disarm them so that they only take in the material you want and not
Exactly. Not
the bad stuff. That's a lot of work. Clearly you were successful.
We were.
So you get this going, and now tell us how this develops. What then do you want to do? Now we've really short-circuited your work by a lot. You've managed to create a bacterium that wants to go after corn. You've figured out a way to disarm it. What is it that you want to bring to this corn now?
Well, that's what we had to figure out. One of the first things that we had in mind was an insect resistance trait. There's a bacterium called Bacillus thuringiensis. Its initials are BT, and these initials have been attached to a protein molecule that the bacterium makes that is toxic to certain kinds of caterpillars called lepidopterans. So we thought if we could make a gene that codes for this BT protein and put that gene into tobacco plants, that the caterpillars wouldn't attack the plant. That was the theory. That was the idea.
And?
And when we tried it with tobacco, it worked pretty well. But when we tried it with corn, it was it presented us with one problem after another. It was the project from hell. It was just we finally figured out what all the obstacles were.
You're working. So one way is to make the seed or the plant resistant to the various pests, plant and animal that it faces. And then the other is to make it, as we've seen in some genetically modified plants, not harmed by broadband insecticides or broadband pesticides so that it'll kill everything else. But I've genetically modified you so that it won't bother – this herbicide won't bother you.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah.
Did you start to focus on that kind of research then?
Yeah, we did. We did. We talked about making – atrazine was the corn herbicide that our company made. And we talked about with the Swiss management, we talked about making atrazine-tolerant soybeans as one project – and they nixed it. And it's interesting why. They said that people would not accept a product that would make the use of atrazine more widespread, that atrazine already people were unhappy with it, and so on. So, but the herbicide resistance trait that did take hold and become widespread used in plants is glyphosate. So glyphosate tolerance was, many companies worked on it, but Monsanto probably worked on it the hardest because they make glyphosate. And they succeeded in getting a glyphosate tolerance gene that worked well.
You at this time, I think your house, first of all, you were pulling together this team, as you said, and you had to mentor many of them. Well, how did you see your role with these essentially student collaborators that you're working, or collaborators who in many ways were your mentees?
That was kind of a family project. Scott was a Fulbright scholar and lived in the home of a German family, and that made him feel like he'd like to put back. So we housed quite a number of
That's your husband,
students.
Scott.
And so, my husband, Scott, yeah.
Yeah, and so it became your house, for that reason, became known as the Chilton Hilton, I understand.
We were the Chilton Hilton. We were.
What was that like?
And that we loved it. Yeah, it was fun. We ate and drank science. It was wonderful. And that continued on after I joined Ciba Geigy, or eventually Syngenta. I had foreign students come live with me. It continued even after Scott's death. So
I have the feeling in talking with you that while you could be a marvelous influence on a young scientist, you don't suffer fools lightly and could be also pretty blunt with them when you needed to be.
I'm blunt. I am.
Yeah. So you talked a little bit about some of the objections that the company itself raised, its worries about the public perception of genetic modification. This has certainly become an issue. There are a lot of people who are very, very frightened about the possibilities here. First, from the standpoint of health, we're very quickly changing the genetic makeup of a plant. There are concerns about our health, what it's going to do to the environment, and what it does to our bodies.
Yeah, there are plenty of public perception problems. And I think one reason I was very happy, one among several, very happy to be on your program was to have an opportunity to say over the radio that this technology is safe. I've worked with it from the very, very beginning. It's a natural process done by Agrobacterium for centuries before we really discovered it. So there's nothing unsafe about the technology per se.
Well, you say it's natural, but there is some intervention here. We are doing things at a rate that nature didn't do. Obviously, that's what this intervention and all the study was all about, right?
Oh, wow. We would hope that we're doing it faster.
Mm-hmm.
The desire is to do things as quickly as possible. Right. But even so, it takes a long time. I mean, a biotech seed that we're going to sell, it's been in the pipeline for about 14 years. And about half of that is in the regulatory process after we have the thing working scientifically. So, it gets lots of regulatory scrutiny.
Given the complexity of the environments that these plants are born into, and all of the relationships with animals and vegetables and then us, are you satisfied that we can properly do the research, enough research quickly enough to satisfy us that it won't have these impacts, given what a matrix of dynamics are involved here? How can we test? Why are you so sure? Tell us that.
Well, a scientist won't tell you anything is true absolutely. You know, I won't tell you that. I'm a scientist. But at the same time, so far as we know, nothing bad has happened thus far from and the technology has produced plants that are on millions of acres in many countries, various parts of the world, and over quite a few growing seasons now. So, no, we haven't had a hint of trouble from the safety point of view.
We should point out that certainly at this point, it is safe to say that the preponderance of scientific evidence about genetically modified organisms is that they are safe. That's just a fact. The preponderance of scientific evidence at this moment shows that. And interestingly enough, and there is counter evidence. There are other studies out there, and there are people who are pretty serious about wanting to make sure those studies are heard. But the preponderance of evidence, and there's been a lot of study. The fact is that other plants come into the world without the kind of scrutiny that we have to give it once it goes into a lab and goes into a plant. We've done a lot more study of GMOs than we have of hybrids that we've made through the ages.
Exactly, yes.
There's another question, though. There's the business side of it, and that is that if you have a patent on a seed, you're owning food. Corporations are in business to make money. Their first responsibility is to shareholders, not to the environment, not to other people. And so, therefore, the danger here is that allowing companies to own patents on life could ultimately lead to some pretty desperate circumstances for us all. Have you thought about the business side of this?
Well, ouch. A patent doesn't mean I own life. I think you rather baldly overstated that. But the patent gives me the right to prevent somebody who doesn't have a license from using my technology, pure and simple.
Well, that could that not lead to a time when I have a monopoly on seeds that are vital to the food supply and therefore control the price, who uses it, whether neighbor farmers, and there have been certain examples of this, who chose not to get put out of business. We've seen examples of it because of the market power of corporations once they own those seeds. Is that a danger?
Well, you know, I'm not a bad guy. I'm only a scientist. And these problems that you're raising are not science problems. They really are problems for an economist, a sociologist, people who know a lot of different kind of things than I do. I don't even know what all the components of the problem are. It's not simple. It wasn't created by my biotechnology, and I'm pretty sure it's not going to be solved by them. There are problems that we may solve, but and I don't know if those are real worries or not.
Yeah.
You're saying that we'll have a problem, but will we?
Well, and it becomes a public policy. In other words, it's not a question you ask a scientist to solve. It's a public policy question, which means the public has to be aware and engaged, and they have to have a government that's willing to listen and then have a large conversation. But if the public isn't engaged in creating a conversation around this, then I think you're in trouble. But I wouldn't assign that responsibility to the scientist.
The scientist has a piece of the problem, though, especially an academic scientist. You know, he needs a funding agency to support his research. If he doesn't have that, it's not going to happen. And, you know, the government funds research. Companies, in part, will fund research in academia. And I think that's a good thing. I came from that system. It was only toward the latter part of my career that I was hired by industry.
And so, there certainly are short-term, in the short run anyway, material benefits. You won the World Food Prize in 2013. Congratulations. Tell us about that experience.
Thank you. Oh, that was quite an honor, quite a deal. You know, they really know how to put on a celebration.
You went out to Iowa for that. What's that for? Tell us what the scope of that prize is. What does that say when you win that prize?
What does it say?
Yeah.
I'm not sure how to answer that, Frank.
But it was an honor for you.
Oh,
it
great
meant
honor.
Something. What did it mean to you?
Well, I think the big thing was that they attached biotechnology to food. You know, it was an affirmation of the potential for this technology to help solve the what we think will be a crisis in food production in the world. The population is projected to increase by 30%, give or take, by the mid-century. That's a lot of mouths to feed.
Particularly when your starting point is 6 or 7 billion. 30% of that is a lot. You're still at it. You're 76 years old. You're still showing up at the lab every day. What are you working on?
I'm working on gene targeting. That's the ability to put our package of genes at a particular spot in a particular chromosome of the plant.
Why is that important?
Well, the hope is that we can identify a good place by putting things in random places, which is what we know how to do now. We can find a good place and then introduce our package of genes to that place every time and have it perform well. Perform well means it'll be stable, it'll express at a decent level, and it'll be stable over generations and over many kinds of environments.
So there are some places along the chromosome where it's just not as stable or is not as likely to take, perhaps.
It seems so, yes, yeah.
So you're looking
at
that.
We don't know how to predict that, but we know one when we find one.
Are there any new technological developments just over the past couple of years that make your job easier?
Yes, we've worked with various technologies that allow us to cut the chromosome of the corn plant or whatever plant you want at a particular point. And that enables us to put our package of genes in the cut. Actually, it enables the plant to do it. The plant does most of the work here.
And you're using enzymes, so this is an entirely kind of biological process, this tailoring.
Exactly.
Mary Dell, what a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much for coming in.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Mary Dell Chilton, a scientist and inventor whose science led to the production of the first genetically modified plant. She has authored more than 100 publications and won the 2013 World Food Prize. You can find out more and see some photos at our website, stateofthings.org. State of Things is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Robin Copley is our technical director. Jess Clark, the intern. Brent Wolf is WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.